Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Code Podcast.
Welcome back to the Short Code Podcast. We're here in Bean community today, freestyling in Bean learning community. Do we know anything about William H. Bean off the top of our heads?
I don't know much about Bean. You know, I spent all my time in McAllen and Boulder.
I'm sure he was a hell of a physician.
Probably.
Otherwise, he wouldn't have a learning community named after him.
That's true.
As always, this summer, I'm here with Lisa Weir.
Hey.
M2. Lisa, you just had a lovely, you just took some time to take a lovely class over at Public Health.
I did. I took a rural health and agricultural medicine class through the College of Public Health. It was 5 days, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day. Pretty intense, but an interesting class.
What did you learn? What's your take-home message?
My take-home message.
From 40 hours of class, what is your take-home message?
Farming is deadly.
Yes. That's what I hear.
Yeah, the highest death rate of any occupation in the United States. I believe it's something like 25 deaths per 100,000 workers.
Okay, does that include medical school clerk? Because there are some very dangerous things that could happen to me.
There are.
I could get a paper cut.
I don't know
cut.
About a death rate, but you might have some injury rates that are pretty hardcore.
I could get a paper
yeah.
cut.
Yeah.
In all seriousness, what are the things farmers have to be concerned about?
Farmers? The highest cause of death is actually tractors. Injury, rollovers, runovers. They're a big piece of equipment. It's pretty easy to die on them. There's also skin cancer is a pretty big one. A lot of them are out in the sun all day, every day. Don't wear sun protection. There are zoonotic diseases you can get from your livestock. There's all sorts of grain dust, musculoskeletal injuries.
We here in Iowa hear a lot about this sort of thing. You know, it happens all the time around us. You hear about crazy things like grain elevator explosions where the dust in the grain elevators... Mm-hmm. sort of catches fire and then explodes
yeah.
or people like essentially drown in grain elevator because they fall
actually in. Really cool. So a guy came down
nothing
is cooler than dying in a grain bin. Someone from Nyack, the Northeast Iowa area community college, I believe.
All right.
He is an EMT or paramedic. Mm-hmm. I never remember the difference. I'm sorry, EMTs and paramedics. But he specifically trains fire departments, rural fire departments, in agriculture injuries and what to do when you're called out to one, how to get the person, you know, to the hospital where you can actually do something. And he has a mock grain bin. It's on a trailer and he can drive it around. So he drove it over to the College of Public Health and he would sink people down to the waist because that's all the further you have to go to get stuck in a grain bin and not get out. And then he taught us how to get someone out of a grain bin. So there are some really cool pictures of me on the College of Public Health website saving someone from a grain bin.
Oh, we'll have to I'll have to remember to put that in the show notes.
In my hard hat and my harness so I don't fall in the grain bin.
Super cute look.
I know, right?
I was going to say, and the other problem with grain bins is that the it's not just the people who fall in, and then you have the people who try to rescue the person who fell in.
It's actually sometimes people, especially like the farmer's family members or something.
Right. You're
they run in to save them instead of calling 911 first, and then you have two people stuck in the grain bin.
Right. This happens. I've heard this happening many times.
Yeah. So
in my 12 years,
word of caution: don't try to save someone from a grain bin yourself.
I am pretty sure that I won't run into that. But if there are any farmers or farmers' families out there listening,
hey, there's quite a few here in Iowa.
There's quite a few farmers who listen to the show.
I'm sure there are
tons. I get calls from our farmer constituent listeners all the time. Well, that's cool. That seems like a pretty good use of your time.
Yeah, I think so. All right. Kept me busy for a week.
All right. Fair enough. I have been, as always, paying attention to the news.
Ooh, what do you got for us this week? I've got one.
Do you? Why don't you start? Go ahead.
So big data. Big data is a big thing in our world these days. All these companies collect data on us. They sell it and all that stuff. So using health data has become a new thing.
Yeah.
And this guy, Dave Vockel, I believe is his name. So Medicare and Medicaid actually released their data sets out to the public and you can use them for whatever you want. And so he was actually at IHOP, and he discovered that IHOP would be a really good place to interview a bunch of seniors on what they wanted. So he got his kids to, you know, be icebreakers and talk to old people at IHOP and find out what they wanted from health data. And they said, you know, they really wanted to know, like, about treatments and if they should have treatments, what it's going to cost them, and they really wanted it in big print. So he made a website using Medicare data, and it's designed to help seniors understand the procedures that their doctors are recommending, as well as the costs involved with them. And it also has a way for the users to print out all the information in large print. So putting health data to work.
That is amazing.
You won a prize at Health Data Palooza this year.
Health Data Palooza.
Yes, it's a big conference. I think it happens in May every year, end of May maybe, something like that.
Have we gotten to the stage that we can just add a palooza?
Apparently.
To anything, and
yeah.
It's awesome.
Health Data Palooza is a fun one to say.
That's amazing. What a great idea.
Yeah, I think it's kind of one of the big things. I mean, coming out, not just healthcare, but I think a lot of places is what we have all this data, and so much of it is locked up in company servers, and one person may not be creative enough to find out all the uses for it, and you kind of farm it out. You know, Medicare and Medicaid, most of the government data is out there for free.
Can you imagine all the stuff we could get out of Epic just in this one hospital?
I know. It's amazing. Yeah.
Not that I'm sure we can't. I'm sure that's not. I guess we could aggregate.
I've actually talked to some people about this. There are some, the hospital without IRB approval, because they can actually go into Epic and anonymously pull data out of charts and stuff. The hospital can use it to evaluate, I think, their like outcomes and whatnot for their own internal review. If you want to use it for a research study, you have to go through IRB to get approval, and the health data or the IT people at the hospital have to pull it out anonymously and just give you the data set. So if you really liked IRB, as we all do.
And who doesn't?
Yeah.
IRB.
But yeah, and if someone's really creative, you have a lot of stuff that comes out of Epic, probably.
Do you have the name? Do you have the address for that website?
No. You know what? I hunted and hunted, and I couldn't find it.
His
website was Life Channel, LYFE.
Well, you know what? We'll
look it up.
We'll try to look for that in the notes. In fact, give me your piece of paper.
You want my piece of paper? Yeah. I have his name on there. Nice. He's the CEO of this company.
Very good.
So
we'll put that in the show notes. Those of us who are not physicians get our medical news from the internet.
The shortcode.
The shortcode. get our news from medical news, medical information from the web. And usually let's face it, that's probably like Facebook, which is really, really unfortunate. I have a story. My son went to day camp this past, started day camp as, you know, school ended this past month. And the first day he was there, I got a call from them and they were like, I don't know what's going on. He's you know, he says he's exhausted. He's weepy and he's just not acting like himself. They knew him fairly well because he's been in there in the past. So they gave me a call and I said, well, let me talk to him. And my son is 9. And I said, you know, what's going on? And he's like, well, I was in the pool and they made me swim like a really long way and I'm just tired and I don't feel good and all this kind of stuff. And I said, well, did you choke on water? Did you breathe in water? And he's like, I don't know, maybe, you know. And immediately what I started thinking about was secondary drowning. Because the day before.
What is secondary drowning?
So apparently, like everybody's familiar with drowning. You breathe in water and you can't breathe anymore and you die.
Yeah.
Secondary drowning happens when you breathe in water, but you don't die until hours later.
Oh.
Because of the damage in your lungs apparently continues and is cumulative and eventually you have big problems and, you know, and you die. So I had just read this article in Facebook literally the day before about secondary drowning. And I was like, oh, holy crap. What if he's drowning? But, you know, fortunately, his family doctor works actually right in Bean Community.
Convenience.
And so I came over and talked to Jill and I said, you know, what do you think about this? And she was like, pretty much, well, you know, if you want to go get him, go ahead. But, you know, it's pretty rare. So, anyway, the point is, no, he's alive and well, in case you were wondering.
Glad to hear that.
Yes, as am I. But it started me thinking about all this crap we get from Facebook about health.
Yeah.
And these health things. And, you know, this is nothing new. We get this all the time. And we have been getting this for a long time, like nitrites. You know, like in the 1970s, nitrites was, you know, declared, you know, this public health problem. It causes cancer and all this. You know, nitrites,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. But my dad always said, nitrates you eat, nitrites you die.
Yeah, well,
not, that's all I ever remember.
Not so much. It turns out, you know, that was cause for concern in the 1970s, but it turns out that your hot dogs contain very tiny amounts of nitrites.
And, yeah, I've heard that.
And while I'm sure if you drank a gallon of nitrite or whatever that stuff is, you'd be in a world of hurt. It's nothing. It's literally, and you create nitrites. And in fact, you secrete them in your saliva. You know, it's part of metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
So. And the amount of nitrite in a hot dog
negligible.
Is like tiny compared to what you're already making. So
it's the other stuff that's the problem.
So that's an example from the past. But then, like, you know, the earthquake in Japan that caused the Fukushima nuclear reactor disaster. Nuclear reactor disaster. This also came out of Facebook. And I always fall for these. I guess because I have no real health background, you know, real scientific background.
Who do you follow on Facebook? Because let me tell you, I don't know that I see this much health stuff on Facebook.
You, okay, so you follow...
I follow, like, the College of Public Health, the College of Medicine.
Apparently, I follow the College of Idiots who, you know, want to make me paranoid. But anyway, yeah, there was this, I remember there was this map that came out on the Fukushima disaster.
Oh, I love maps.
It purported to show the spread of radiation.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, you know, it's a frightening looking map because, number one, the colors are all like, you know,
red
and, you know, awful, you know, like alarm colors.
Yeah.
You know. But really, it was, you know, so I was like, oh, my God, I'm never going to eat fish again. Christine, we got to move to the East Coast. Blah, blah, blah. My wife, who is a scientist, talked me down. It turns out that the map is really the height of waves following the Tohoku earthquake that caused the Fukushima disaster and the Hawaii Department state. So, you know, yeah, the height of waves. Not really that concerned, but, you know, it's...
Yeah, yeah.
The map makes it look like, radiation is spreading throughout the world. The Hawaii State Department of Health says, you know, basically, the water is diluting the radiation. So, A, that's good. Sad that the radiation has to be in the water, but
yeah. You
know, as far as a public health disaster, not so much. Fish do take up radioactive isotopes, but most isotopes rapidly decay, enough so that quickly reaches background radiation levels. So, you know, it's things like this.
Mm-hmm.
1993, David Raynard on Larry King. So, I'm looking up all of these things that I believed in when I was a younger man, or actually today. What am I talking about? David Raynard on Larry King was on Larry King. I don't know who David Raynard is.
I've never heard the name.
This was 1993. I was like 23 years old. I didn't care about news. Cell phone. He said that his cell phone use caused his wife's fatal brain tumor.
Oh, I've heard that one.
And that statement led to, you know, media hype.
Mm-hmm.
I should have found out who this David Raynard is, because, you know, why is he on Larry King, and why do we care? I mean, you know, it's tragic that his wife had a brain tumor and didn't live.
Yeah.
But why was that brain tumor the catalyst for media hype, which led to numerous studies that found zero correlation, but it still persists?
It's like the vaccine and autism one.
Yeah. Well, in 2004, the Karolinska Institute in Sweden used self-reported data to correlate brain tumors with the side of the head the subjects used their cell phones on. And I think you could probably see, even I could see the problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
Who the hell knows what side of the head they use their cell phone on?
I think I use both.
I mean,
depends on how tired my arm is.
Right. Or what you're carrying.
Yeah.
So recall bias, they were more likely to have brain tumors on the side that they claimed to use their
phone. Well, I mean, if you had a brain tumor, you'd probably want any excuse and be like, of course it's on my left side.
Recall bias was at work there. They were asking about behavior from a decade earlier when cancer sort of starts happening.
I mean, that's a problem with any retrospective study, especially one where the subjects already have the disease.
Yes. And of course, we have to bring up autism and vaccines, which is my personal bugaboo. Even I know that that is the stupidest thing in the world. Andrew Wakefield did his famous study. And I didn't know this. First of all, the sample size that Andrew Wakefield used to come out with his, I guess we can call it, seminal work on autism and vaccines. The sample size was 12 children.
What?
Yeah.
I did not know that either.
Blood samples were purchased. This is according
to... I was going to say, I knew he made up all the data, didn't he?
Well, blood samples were purchased from friends of the researcher's son at a birthday party. So, and he had a, Wakefield had a patent for a rival measles vaccine, which he wanted to be safer, wanted to declare far safer than the MMR vaccine. So, obviously, yeah. Had a financial incentive.
Huh.
And then thanks to certain celebrity idiots, we now have a whooping cough epidemic in California that's killing people. As of, so I looked up this whooping cough epidemic. As of June 10th this year, there were 3,458 cases reported in 2014. That's more than in all of 2013. So we're having some sort of spike.
Oh, wow.
Well, it's a little hard to declare that a definite, like, as definitely yeah. as a result of, you know, not vaccines, because apparently the cycle peaks every 3 to 5 years anyway. We're about due.
Okay.
Last peak was in 2010. But fewer vaccinations probably aren't helping things, I would.
No.
So anyway, I have resolved to
use better sources like Wikipedia.
Yes, straight to Wikipedia. First of all, I have as an employee of the college and the university, I do have access to medical journals. I have no idea what you people are saying in them.
That half the time I don't know what they're saying.
That's good news for the future.
Yeah, right. I don't know. It made me think of. I know last year I was maybe in the fall already doing some reading. One of the California schools, Stanford, maybe had an elective class for fourth year students to write Wikipedia articles. So they had better medical knowledge because a lot of people get their health knowledge from the internet, and Wikipedia is a great one. And so they were updating different articles with, you know, scientific studies and better data so that people were getting accurate health information.
Most of the time, if I look at the abstract, I'm like, okay, I understand.
That's a good place to go.
But then when, you know, you actually try to read the article, it's like, well, there's a p-value of 0.017, blah, blah, blah. So obviously that means that the T is the... And I'm like, this is the problem with with science. It's complicated.
It is.
MedCityNews.com. This is from MedCityNews.com. An ER doc named Charlotte Yeh, I think, Y-E-H, got hit by a car in Washington, D.C., and she went to the ER and got to see things from the patient's perspective. And so she wrote this long article, and I would encourage all med students to actually look up this article because most of us are fairly healthy. We don't spend a lot of time in the hospital. She, unfortunately, this accident in which she was a pedestrian, got hit by a car, resulted in a rather long, you know, sort of protracted difficulties for her. So she had a lot of time to think about all this stuff. So she got to see things as a patient. And surprise, surprise, fragmented communication, incredibly poor listening skills, a rush to discharge with no plan, nor coordination of care, distracted and overworked staff were the things that she experienced. Again, I have a parallel. I have experience in this myself.
Mm-hmm.
In 1995, I became very ill and I had no insurance, of course. Went to the emergency room where was always my fallback plan. It wasn't a huge hospital like this case. I think in this case it was Washington, D.C., but they must have been busy enough. They discharged me 3 times over the course of 3 days. With basically what I kind of came to believe were sort of BS explanations for what was happening. Turned out I had Guillain-Barré syndrome. And within 3 days of, I went back to the ER 3 times saying, what the hell, it's getting worse.
Yeah.
And by the 4th day, I was on a respirator and had control of my left pupil.
Wow.
And so it ended up pretty bad. Could have been ameliorated had action been taken sooner. But of course, I had no insurance, and the staff probably were overworked. And I had I had Miller-Fisher variant, so it was a weird variation of Guillain-Barré syndrome that was extremely or much more rare, even than GBS. So, what do we do about this?
Well, my first thought is,
I mean, does every doctor, the premise of the article I read was like, does every doctor have to get hit by a car in order to recognize it? See what is going on?
I would certainly hope not.
Maybe every hospital.
Think of the public health implications of that. I mean, I wonder, I don't know that it really makes that much. Clearly, this happened today, but electronic health records, like maybe something like yours would have been prevented. Did they know that you'd been in there every day for 3 days? I assume you told them that. You probably were like, I was here yesterday.
I was here yesterday, for God's sake.
You know, I would hope that like the system would show up and be like, huh, they were in the ER yesterday. Yeah, but maybe not. It should.
I think it was the third time I was sent home. It was like, oh, well, maybe you have Bell's palsy and also you've been sleeping on your arms and that's why your arms are numb. And even at the time I was like, say what? That is your explanation for this?
Yeah, it's a little far-fetched.
So, anyway. This doctor, this ER doc, Dr. Ye, suggests that the North Star, as she says, guiding all patient care must be that providers are using any means possible to know the patient, to hear the patient, to respond to what matters to the patient, to listen to them. And because basically throughout her experience, she was saying, you know, this is not right. You know, what's happening to me isn't right. You need to look at this closer. You need to do, you know, basically being an advocate for yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, listen up.
I don't know. That's an okay solution. Like, I think that is important. But at the same time, that puts a lot of responsibility on the individual.
It does not. It does not address.
No, I think the bigger problems are the system problems. And in terms of public health, like, you want to go for the system because individuals are unpredictable,
right,
and not reliable.
And you know, it doesn't address the system problems being like
overworked, too many patients, yeah.
Under, I don't know what else. Too many
understaffed. Yeah.
That's what it sounded like anyway. Did you read this thing about the geneticist who sequenced his unborn son's genome using DIY biology tools?
I did not.
Interesting, I thought. He's a Razib Khan, is a grad student in the U.S. I didn't take note of where he's working, but he's a grad student, professional blogger on genetics. He says he worked out a rough draft of his son's genome earlier this year in a DIY fashion. After managing to obtain a tissue sample from the placenta of the unborn baby during the second trimester, apparently that's not easy to do.
I would imagine not.
I think it was sent. I think the tissue was sent off for a test, and you know, he wanted to get it back for this purpose. And ultimately, you know, they were like, no,
yeah,
you can't have.
Ethically, I don't know anyone who would willing. You know,
well, he convinced his wife and his doctor to apply to get this. But apparently, it is routine to have you know, your doctor ask for the sample back so they can do more testing and all this stuff. So, he does admit that it was more cool than practical. I think as a geneticist, you know, like I would want to if I was a geneticist just for kicks.
That's true.
And he wanted to show that sequencing DNA has become so cheap and easy that it's routine to use, that it's going to be in very short order routine to do this in pregnancy or during pregnancy as a way to get a broad view of fetus's health. It's starting to look pretty in it.
I think we need to know a little more about genetics before it becomes routine.
Well, yeah, I mean, aside from, you know, who gets to control that data.
Yeah.
You could discover sort of information that could lead parents to make an irrevocable decision.
Yeah.
Like abortion.
Talk about dystopian future coming.
Yeah, and DNA isn't always destiny, as we know. So.
Yeah. I think that's the biggest challenge, is we can find associations in DNA, but it's never a guarantee, and we don't. Association, cause, effect, we never quite know the full connection there.
Well, the truth is, I mean, I think he's right. I think this is going to happen. The cost of gathering sequencing DNA is plummeting. It's only a few thousand dollars now to sequence your entire genome. People are going to start saying, why not?
Yeah.
And we're probably not ready for it yet.
No, I would say not. I feel like I'm being a skeptic on everything today.
You are. This is good. You're like the skeptic to my moron. But, you know, basically, he the justification, aside from, well, it was just kind of
blue. Yeah, I mean, it is kind of cool.
He says, you know, our attitude, meaning him and his wife, he and his wife, our attitude is that you make a lot of decisions for your kids, including ones that may seem sketchy in hindsight. It's true. As a parent, I could say that it's true. We do make decisions for our children that later you're like, that was the dumbest thing. And it's, you know. But anyway, I love that he's like, I'm going to make stupid decisions anyway. I might as well make stupid decisions. Yeah. Oh, well. Entrepreneur.com. This is the story, the aggregation of marginal gains. So, as I said, it was from entrepreneur.com. And it was the story of a British cycling team whose general manager decided that the way to win the Tour de France, which they'd never done, Brits had never done, was to improve every area related to cycling by 1%.
Yeah, reasonable.
Which should add up to a much greater improvement. So they optimized the usual suspects like nutrition and training programs and ergonomics and the weight of their mm-hmm. equipment, you know, their cycles and stuff. But they searched for 1% improvement in all other things, everything they could think of, from, you know, hand washing to improve, you know, to, you know, improve infections or avoid infections, testing different massage gels that they used, you know, even the best pillows for sleeping so that they took them with them to their hotels, the best pillows that they could have for sleeping. And he figured they'd make enough changes to win in 5 years, and they did in three. I feel like this has an important message.
I'm not going to be skeptical on this one.
No,
I believe this.
This makes total sense.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, I don't want to be the guy who's like, I do this in my everyday life. But in a way, I do. You know, like I'm always looking, like, you know, for my, you know, tasks at work or whatever. I'm always looking for little teeny things that I can change or fix because, you know, I want to, you know, be as proficient. And you know, mm-hmm. so I've sort of already been doing this, although not, I mean, I hope we all do this, really. We all look for a little gain.
Yeah, I would hope so.
But I feel like this has an important message for medicine and healthcare.
I think there's been somewhat of a push for that, you know. You don't have to lose all the weight. Even losing small percentages of it can make big gains in health, too.
But it seemed like, even like, you know, like we look for big things to change. Like, mm-hmm. you know, let's... And I have no problem with the Affordable Care Act, but you know, that's one example of a big change.
Very big.
Very difficult to do, very you know, complicated. But there are little tiny things that we can do that add up to really big deals. So I thought that was kind of, I mean, it's obvious in hindsight, but, you know, just constantly be making little changes that will add up to it. Probably students can...
I also wonder, you know, change is a really difficult thing, and... I'm still on the public health kick. You know, I have my master's in public health.
Shut up about public health.
I have a master's in public health, and then I spent it all last week in public health, so it's, you know, forefront in my brain right now. Behavior change is a really hard thing, and it's really hard to get people to make changes and keep changes. And I think people are more likely to make a small change because they feel more confident that they can do it.
Right.
As opposed to, I have to overhaul my whole life tomorrow. Not going to happen. But, you know, can I eat one more fruit tomorrow? Probably.
Sure.
So.
Sure. And probably, you know, as students, you can make little changes in how you do things every day. Like, I'm going to study 10 minutes more today than I did, I don't know, I did last week. I know, that's crazy. Forget it. I'm going to go to the bar.
You might hit good studying points at the end of 4 years.
Okay. Never mind. Terrible idea for students. Do not improve things by 1% every day. The last thing I have to talk about today is a story from the Chronicle of Higher Education. Case Western was apparently ordered by a judge to grant a diploma to a medical student who had completed all of their academic requirements but had been dismissed, including having secured a Durham residency.
Oh.
But lacked professionalism.
Mm.
So here there's a list of things that the student supposedly lacked professionalism, or the ways that the student supposedly... Yes, you get it. Didn't report an out-of-state arrest for DUI. Trying to cover up latenesses. Rude behavior with patients. Trying to avoid cab fare by jumping out of a moving cab. Complaints from patients. Giving patient summaries where he might not have actually examined the patient. But Judge James S. Gwynn of the U.S. District Court in Cleveland sided with the student. Although courts, he said, should give almost complete deference to university judgments regarding academic issues, the same deference does not follow universities' character judgments, especially on character judgments only distantly related to medical education.
Wow.
I'm a little troubled by this, actually.
That's disturbing.
Yeah. The judge said that Case Western had arbitrarily and capriciously decided that the student couldn't have his diploma and ordered the university to grant it to him. That, to me, is crazy talk. Right there.
Professionalism is a pretty big deal here.
It is.
They've incorporated it into a lot of classes.
Absolutely.
You have X number of professionalism points, and doing things like that, you lose points, and you lose too many points, and you don't pass the class.
So my question after reading this is, when did the school find out?
That is a really good question.
If they found out 2 years before he graduated, then they probably should have done something about it then.
Yeah. Did they give him fair warning, too?
Yeah. Actually, you know what? No. I don't really believe that. I don't really think that's... In this case, I'm sorry. If you are doing things like, you know, jumping out of cabs and...
That's pretty hardcore.
Yeah, jumping out of cabs, if you're getting DUIs and not reporting it, if you're you know, doing the things that are claimed that this student did, you know... Yeah, I mean, at some point you do it. You definitely have an obligation, I think, to say, you know, hey,
yeah.
knock it off.
Yeah.
But if you discover these things sort of all at once, yeah.
Yeah.
There's no
warning. If you do them all
there.
At once, no, there's
you're
no warning.
You're a loser.
But I think if you discover them one by one, you should definitely be putting that out there. Granted, this kid's going to have to come up against a state licensing board, and I really hope they have more sway than going to school.
Yeah.
Or he's cleaned up his act.
I don't... Yeah, no,
I don't know if there's a lot of hope in that case.
I sense a personality flaw here.
Yeah.
But anyway. So, yeah, we do put a lot of emphasis on professionalism. I think at the college, definitely, and probably medical school as a whole do this. I mean, it's not all about the grades or even the clinical skills. It's about, you know, who you are. So, anyway, that was a little scary to me.
Yeah.
That's all I got.
It's been good.
Yeah. I'm so happy we're doing this.
It's fun. It gives me a nice little outlet.
Yeah. And, you know, we'll keep doing it. Do you have time next week, maybe?
I start MECO next week. But we'll find a time.
We'll definitely find a time. Thank you for listening to The Short Coat. See you next time.
See ya.
The Short Coat is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine with support from Medical Student Government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter too, where we post not only our episodes but news and info for medical students. We also take comments and story ideas from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com, or leave us a voice message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. The producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our opening music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing theme music is by RAC. Thanks for listening. But what I see's a child.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.